Hi, I'm Greg Schaefer, and welcome to the Virtual CISO Moment. Nick Mullen joins us today. He is founder and principal consultant of Sanguine Security Solutions. Nick, thank you so much for joining us today.
Happy to be here, Greg.
So I'd love to hear about your path, how you got started in IT and cybersecurity, and why. It's certainly an interesting field. And then just bring us all the way through to launching your own business.
Sure. So I've got a little bit of a strange path, probably like most people. So I was a college dropout. When I was going to college the first time, it was a little bit tougher to get student loans than it is today. And I ran out of money. And so I started working pretty much any sort of job that I could, retail, food service. I sold cars for a while. I was a bill collector for a while. And then, I also started doing some physical security work, at a concert hall, a music venue. And, but eventually I ended up, landing a contract job, working in IT. A local organization was bringing in a lot of contractors through a staffing company. And, I got kind of an entry level job there. And, that was the launch point for me. I got some experience working with cloud and with data. And then eventually I started working on some security projects and doing some project management work and things like that. And when I started doing some security work, I saw the parallels between what I had done in physical security and with, a lot of the controls that we put in place for information security and cybersecurity. And that really kind of changed things for me. It was the first job that I had where I really felt like what I was doing was making a difference. And I wasn't just, working a job where I was making somebody else a bunch of money. It felt like a genuine noble cause. You're helping protect critical services and infrastructure for real people and real assets. So I kind of fell in love, and it made a lot of sense to me. So I went back to school for security, ended up working in various project management roles, kind of supporting IT and security. And then in 2022, I ended up launching my own consulting business focused on solution delivery and cybersecurity.
So tell us a little bit more about what your company does.
Yeah, so we, over the last couple of years, our main focus has been project management and security, which initially I thought was pretty narrow because there aren't a lot of security specific project managers out there. What I found out was that's not really all that narrow. So we're really trying to redefine what our main mission is, which is really going to be around user security and user protection.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I project management. Actually, my master's is in information systems project management. I had the choice of doing that or doing concentrating on information security, but I'm like, well, I'm already doing that full time, so
yeah,
didn't really seem to make too much sense. You talked about some parallels between physical security and cybersecurity. What kind of parallels were you thinking about there?
Well, most of, at least in my opinion, most of the great ideas that we have in cyber, we've lifted from physical security concepts or things that the military has been doing for a long time. When I first started getting exposed to cyber, I had somebody that was a security architect that had been doing this for several years, and he really kind of helped make that one-for-one correlation for me. Mm-hmm. And the way that he put it to me was, imagine you've got a pot of gold that you're trying to protect. You wouldn't leave it out in your front lawn. You'd probably take it in your house, and if you didn't want anybody to come in your house, you'd lock the door. If mm-hmm. you didn't want anybody to come on your lawn, you put a fence up around your lawn. You can add signs on your lawn that say no trespassing. You can put up security cameras. You can get a dog. You can then take that pot of gold and stash it in the basement and hide it in a safe. Those are all the same types of things that we do in cybersecurity. With firewalls, with detective controls, with administrative controls or directive controls. We do the same thing with honeypots. We do the same thing trying to, obfuscate data. It's a lot of the same concepts. It's just applied a little bit differently because we're trying to protect, you know, a logical resource rather than a physical one.
And do you find that when you're explaining this to like a general user, that it helps them to understand cybersecurity concepts by distilling it to something that matching it to something that they know and live every day?
100%. That's been the easiest way for me to correlate things to people that aren't necessarily in the know or in the weeds for cybersecurity. Is most people understand physical security. They understand what a security guard is, or what a motion light is, or a camera or something like that. And then when you say, hey, we're applying a lot of the same concepts here in the cybersecurity space, they can really start to understand what that means and how it's being applied, because they see it every day in their, in the real world.
Got to ask one more question about your background. And as far as like, was there anything that applied from that to cybersecurity? And that's being a car salesman, because I actually, and a lot of people don't realize this, but in cybersecurity and information security, part of what we do is sales. And mm-hmm. and I'm not talking about if you're like at a VAR or something and you're trying to sell a service. I'm like, you're trying to sell people on the concept of cybersecurity and information security. Mm-hmm. So anything from car sales that translated well or not quite?
No, absolutely. Just the understanding the difference between a legitimate objection and an excuse. There are a lot of individuals that may object to something because they don't quite understand or they don't see the value add. And those are things that you need to overcome, versus excuses because you just don't want to do something. Those are things that you may not ever really be able to overcome because they don't want you to overcome them. So the way that you kind of address those two scenarios, that was something that I learned very early in sales, and that I still apply today.
So there are some cases where this great Mustang that you're trying to sell, that there are some people that no matter what you say about it, they're just never going to buy it.
Correct. 100%.
Well, for those who don't want to buy it, send them to me.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. So you've been doing this for quite some time. What's your client base, first of all, with regards to Sanguine Security Solutions, like typically?
Small business or mid-market. I'm not staffed to handle an enterprise, level client or a Fortune 500. I mostly kind of play in that small to mid-market.
I was wondering when we were going to introduce the word enterprise to this conversation. So very well done. We were talking before the recording and about your Star Trek treat back there with all sorts of different variations of the ships, including the Borg cube, which I see right there as well.
Yeah, the Borg cube even talks. there's a couple of them that talk.
I'm assuming that it says something about assimilation.
100% correct.
Very good. Okay, now where was it? We were talking about SMBs. Yes, that's the reason why I asked about your client base, because that's what I thought. But so from your perspective, not only in your career as you've gone through, but right now with who you deal with your client base, what would you say is one or a few of the most significant threats, risks even, that small and mid-sized businesses face with regards to cybersecurity and or information security?
I'd say probably the biggest threat that they face right now is, and I hate to be on the bandwagon for this, but automation and AI. It's making the barrier for entry easier for bad actors. And it's making the, particularly in the social engineering space, you look at what you can do with video and voice deep fakes. You look at what you can do with automating phishing campaigns, spear phishing and intel gathering. It's completely changed the OSINT landscape. And if you are a bad actor and you're wanting to target, even a mid-market or a small business, it's a lot easier, it's faster, and it's cheaper than it's ever been. Meanwhile, that market is a little bit slower to adopt technology. And I'm not sure if all the controls and the protections that most organizations have in place are scaling with the threat landscape.
Of course, recently, and you mentioned deepfakes. Recently, you probably remember, I think maybe it's been about a week or so from when we're recording this now, that there was the $25 million transfer that this one executive in this video call, I think it was Zoom, with several other folks, but everybody else on the call was AI generated. They were all, or rather, they were all deepfakes, I should say. So, which is huge, a huge thing, because just talking with somebody on Zoom or Teams or what have you, it's something that we've all become accustomed to. We learn pretty rapidly. We had to during COVID, and we've learned to trust it. And now the bad actors are exploiting that, particularly though for small and mid-sized businesses. What, if anything, do you think is a way that they could counter that sort of threat of like deepfakes in an important video call?
Well, there's a few things that you can kind of look at. The first one is understanding that the attack surface for everyone isn't the same. You know, if you've got someone that primarily interacts with the outside world via email, then, you know, the way that a bad actor is going to approach them is going to be dramatically different than somebody who, you know, primarily interacts with the outside world in person, or maybe via telephone. So understanding the needs of the different types of users that you have in your organization is paramount. The other thing is, this isn't a, you know, impersonation, which is really what this is. It's very advanced and sophisticated impersonation, but this isn't anything new. We've seen this in, again, the physical security space, and the military's dealt with this for decades, you know, probably even longer than that. And so a lot of times they employ, you know, a second layer of defense, additional controls to make sure that you've, you know, validated the identity of the person that you're talking to before you do something like execute a $25 million wire transfer. You know, there's organizations that have those controls in place today, but there's far more that don't. And I think the reason for that is because everybody thinks this isn't going to happen to me. And you can think that right up until it does. And then you're going to sit back and think, you know, what could I have done differently? Well, there are things that you can do differently. There are different, tools that are coming out. I believe IBM and Intel have both, released, news publications that they've developed tools to detect deepfakes with 98% accuracy. I don't think that those are, available to the public or, you know, for commercial use yet, but they will be pretty quickly. And like I said, the other thing is just having a second layer of defense, whether it be, you know, some sort of passphrase, some sort of authenticator mechanism, or, you know, the having two people sign off on something rather than just one, to make it a little bit difficult to social engineer people through that mechanism.
And that's a good point with regards to that, the dual control, if you will, in the financial services sector. They've been doing that for ages. If you're going to institute a wire over a certain nominal amount, maybe it's like 10,000 or something along those lines, you have to have two separate people performing two separate actions.
Right.
And I think that this is a great example because I think that you're right. I think that if there is some sort of layered controls on top of that, just to authenticate, to be sure that the person that you're talking to is the person you're talking to, that's a fairly easy way, I put easy in air quotes, to solve something like this. But most organizations, most verticals don't even think about dual control when they do stuff. Right. And I think this is one great example of learning from one sector to another. How would that work, though, pragmatically? If let's just say you and I are on this call right now, you're not sure if it's me, how would that have worked?
I mean, that's a little bit more difficult, and I think it's somewhat dependent on the organization. You could do something like go into, you know, a Slack or a Teams Messenger and send a message. You could send an email and ask for a confirmation in writing. However, I mean, if they're already in the network, then, you know, that makes it, that control is a little bit less effective. You can use things like identity verification services. There are a few of those that hook into things like Okta, where you can send a push notification to an authenticator on their phone and ask them to do that in real time. If it were me and I was in charge of, you know, a financial silo in a large organization, I'd be looking to employ some sort of push identification or push authentication for any large money transfer.
Now, when you're talking about small and mid-sized businesses, particularly on the smaller side, let's just talk startups for a second. You've got folks that they're running lean and mean. They right. are they're focused on just one thing. A lot of times they've got investors that are looking at milestones, and you have to do something by this milestone. Otherwise, guess what? Your startup ends right then and there. And they're not going to want to put in more friction than they have to in any sort of process. Drawing perhaps maybe from your car sales days, how would you approach not just the deepfake, but just in general SMBs to convince them of the value of instituting a certain control? It could be like a dual control for high level transactions, or it could be something else just in general.
Yeah. You know, I think you have to make it, you have to actually show them what it looks like in real life. A lot of people, they have a little bit of a fear of the unknown, and they think, you know, hey, we're employing all these additional controls. It's going to be this huge time suck. It's going to, you know, people are going to resist it. It might be, you know, an extra minute added on to a process. People may resist it for a week or two, but realistically, you know, as long as you're doing your job as far as educating and rationalizing what you're asking for, most people will adopt that pretty easily. So, you know, you're basically talking about organizational change management, getting people to the point where they understand the value and getting them to actually kind of adopt the change. You know, from an actually employing the control standpoint and spending the money, you can look at the statistics. You know, most organizations that or like small and mid-market organizations that have been breached, it's a really significant business impact for them. There's a large percentage of those businesses that they don't recover. In fact, locally here in Central Illinois, it's actually my wife's alma mater, Lincoln College. They're the first college in the United States to go out of business because of a ransomware attack.
Wow.
They were ransomed right during COVID, and they couldn't enroll a new semester of students, and they never came back. The college is closed down now.
I do remember hearing about that, and that was, I won't say surprising, I will say a little bit shocking in some ways. It's like, not surprised that they got ransomware, but that it actually brought down an institute of higher education.
Mm-hmm.
It's when we're talking about small and mid-sized businesses, though, they where was I going to go with this with regards to the traction? One of the things I found is that, again, if you can make sure that you minimize the amount of friction that's there by at least trying to explain to them that there is a business impact. And I think that that's where you were going with like talking about Lincoln, for example. So this is less about trying to make things worse and more about trying to save your business, because and ultimately then that's the real sales that we're talking about here, is that we're trying to position information security as a business enabler. That sort of wraps it up correctly.
Yeah, 100%. And you know, if you're talking to a business owner, you know, I would ask the question, would you not put locks on the front door of your building because it takes more time to turn the key? Nobody would say that's a good idea, to leave the building unlocked because it takes more time to open it up in the morning. You know, so you would look at the same thing from a cyber perspective of, you know, you have to employ the same controls or similar controls. And even if it means that things take a little bit longer, you know, you're doing it for a reason. A lot of times I think people get scared because the tools that they see out there, they're enterprise grade tools. And they're not, you know, they're not turnkey solutions. They require, you know, administrative overhead. They cost a lot of money. If you go out and you're just Googling, you know, an EDR solution, if you're a business with 100 people and you go out and you try to price, you know, one of the top two or three EDR solutions out
there. Forget it. Yeah.
Oh yeah. You're going to say, nope, I can't do this. You know, there are other solutions out there that are designed and kind of catered for the mid-market. Just a lot of organizations don't know about them. So that's why, you know, hopefully there's folks like you or folks like me that can, you know, we have experience in this sector and we can introduce them to the right tools that are actually designed for them.
Well, you touched upon now the two reasons that there would be a resistance. The first being the friction added, and the second being the cost, and both can be managed. The friction adding, the way that I, one of the analogies I like to tell people or to explain, it's like when you get in your car, you probably put on your seatbelt, right? I mean, you just do that. There was a time, you know, many years ago that seatbelts were optional. You had vehicles that you just didn't have them in there. It wasn't a law at the time. You know, we're spooling back about 50 years, but even today, I've known people that won't wear seatbelts because they just feel it's uncomfortable. But the thing about it is that, to your point that you said a little while ago, it's like after you do it for about a week or whatever, it becomes second nature. So, so don't worry about that. I mean, Nick's spot on with regards to that. Just like the seatbelt, it's like if you're told that you have to do multi-factor authentication, don't worry about it. It's going to save you. I mean, it might not save you going through a dashboard, but or a windshield, but it'll save your business.
Yeah, 100%.
And I don't mean to make any other small and mid-sized business owners more stressed out than they are. We already know that running a small and mid-sized business is pretty stressful. You run one, I run one. And plus, we have the double whammy that we're in information security and cybersecurity. And that in and of itself is stressful. We've got a huge problem in our industry with folks that are burning out. Sometimes they're burning out because they're trying to get in the industry, and that can be it's very difficult to get in right now. We're in a bad job market phase right now, but for everybody that's worried about that, it always goes down and up and down and up. When you're in the trough, it'll come back up.
Yep.
What's one or a couple of things that you do to help decompress and get away from all this stress so that it doesn't overconsume you?
Well, I have three young kids. I don't know if that necessarily means that I've got a stress relief valve there.
Just stress transfer.
Transference of stress. I really love spending time with them. We do a lot of like fishing and camping and things like that.
Not email fishing.
Okay. No,
just had to be sure.
I'm big into like crappie, bass, trout, walleye. So I like to usually go on a couple fishing trips a year. I'm also big into motorsports. So I usually try to go to a handful of races a year. I'm about 2 hours away from Indianapolis Motor Speedway. So last year I got to take my two girls, 7 and 4, to IMS for the first time and watch an IndyCar race, which was, you know, a fantastic experience for them. So yeah, you know, I try to do things that are outside of the technology sector. You know, kind of get outdoors and experience some things in the real world. And that helps me unplug quite a bit.
I've actually been to that speedway once, not for a race, but just to visit. And but that's been a long, long time. I don't remember much. And also because there was also some adult beverages involved, I should say.
I understand. So they've got something really cool. I'm going to plug IMS here. So there's a solar eclipse that's happening here in a couple months. And they've got a viewing party at Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And apparently the eclipse is going to silhouette the big, is it like a Pedega that they got, you know, right in the middle of the track. So it should be a pretty cool view.
That's awesome. Yeah, I was considering making a trip up to Buffalo to view the eclipse. I decided not to because we had one a few years ago that just happened to go right through Middle Tennessee where I'm at. Mm-hmm. I will say this, if you've never had the opportunity to see a solar eclipse once in your life, take advantage of it because it is the weirdest thing. The sky does go dark. Mm-hmm. You do see stars out and it does get colder. It is just, and it freaks out the nature, the birds. They don't know what time of day it is. It is really quite an awesome display of nature. So
absolutely.
Nick, what are your future plans that you might want to talk about? You're gonna have to get another tree as more Star Trek episode series come out, you know?
Yeah, I need to find out whether Hallmark's made some Picard or Strange New Worlds ships that I can add to the tree.
You know, there's money involved. I'm sure they have.
Yeah. So. You're spot on. No. So, you know, really what I'd like to focus on over the next year is this idea of, you know, getting better and more intentional with protecting users and being smarter about the way we do it. Not taking a one size all fits or one size all, approach to user security, understanding that different people have different needs, whether it be from the tools that we deploy or the training that we provide to prepare and protect them. So I'd really like to continue moving on in that space. And my plan is to really kind of center my entire consulting business around that.
That sounds awesome. How can people get a hold of you if they want to?
Yeah, so I have the longest domain name ever at sanguinesecuritysolutions.com, but you can reach me there. You can find me on LinkedIn. I've got a pretty good presence on there. You can reach me by email at nick.mullen@sanguinesecuritysolutions.com.
Well, Nick, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on here this morning to share both some wisdom about information security and a little bit about solar eclipses and racing and Star Trek. Appreciate your time here this morning.
Yep. Thanks so much for having me, Greg.
Everybody, stay secure.